Now, for decades, Australian teenage girls would pick up a copy of Dolly magazine and inevitably flick to the Dolly Doctor section, where the anonymous doctor would dispense wisdom in response to questions written in about periods or body hair or crushes or anything else that obsessed a teenage girl. All the mysteries and miseries of early teenage life. For 23 years, the doctor answering those heartfelt letters, and they were all real letters, was Dr. Melissa Kang. She has continued working as a doctor, mainly with disadvantaged and homeless youth, even after Dolly Doctor hung up her stethoscope in 2016 when the magazine went out of print. Dr. Melissa Kang, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Hello, thanks for having me here.
Now, before you were Dolly Doctor, you were a girl who read Dolly Doctor. I didn't know it went. How can I say this back so far?
It does, and it was actually, it predated magazines like Clio. It was one of the very first women's magazines in Australia, and it was launched, I gather, in 1970. So I was definitely reading it as a teenager.
And what were you reading it for as a teenager?
Probably the stories on celebrities and fashion, like a lot of the readers did. But like everybody, I think we all turned to the Dolly Doctor section first. I think it was much smaller in the first few decades. It only expanded during the time that I was writing for it, and that was a sort of editorial decision.
So not that very much longer after you were reading it, you were writing it.
That's right.
Where did the letters come from, and what form did they take?
When I first started writing for Dolly, which was 1993, they were still mailed letters, handwritten or typed, mailed in letters. They came from all over the country. There might have even been some from New Zealand. I wouldn't have had any access to those original letters except that I asked. After my first few months of answering the five questions they would fax to me, I said, look, I'd just like to get a sense of what girls are writing in about. Can I see a few more than five? And they said, sure, here's a box load. Literally a box load turned up on my doorstep one day. And then about 6 or 8 months later, they said, would you like another box load? Because we're about to throw them out. So I still have actually hundreds and hundreds of handwritten letters.
And what did you tell them?
Well, it was tricky sometimes because there was so much angst and you sort of wanted to give them a virtual hug a lot of the time. I suppose I felt that my role and my authority as a doctor meant that I had to address whatever the medical or biological question was about. So if it was about, well, a very common question was, you know, why do I have this discharge in my underpants? So just explaining the kind of physiological or body changes of puberty, why that was there, but reassuring them that this was a very healthy, natural experience.
There used to be a theory in television before the digital age that everybody who wrote a letter in represented 10,000 other people who had the same view. Did you get that feeling that you'd be answering one letter but really answering questions that were in the minds of many?
I think so. And I took that approach. I used to ask myself, okay, what's the broader message here for the whole readership? Because really, I did do an analysis, several actually over the years, of the content of the questions, just so I could see for myself from a quantitative perspective, well, how many questions are actually about periods or discharge or sex? And so, you know, they really were all about puberty, the great, great majority, and about feelings and crushes and friendships and those kind of relationship kinds of issues. So I think just based on that, those analyses, I could reassure myself that answering a specific question was probably addressing the concerns of, well, at least the majority of the readership.
So Dolly continued publishing until 2016. Did you notice by the end any change in the subject matter?
Yes and no. I think the experience of going through puberty is universal. So sorts of questions about body changes and relationships didn't change at all. What I did notice were a couple of specific things. One was the disappearance of pubic hair. And we're all very clear now that that was a direct result of, you know, the exponential availability and access to online pornography and the fact that both girls and boys were seeing these changes and thinking that that was what everybody did. So there were lots of questions, whereas there were none in the first few years about how to remove pubic hair. That suddenly became a relatively regular sort of question. The other change I noticed, I suppose, was a more informed audience in that girls were able to name parts of their genital anatomy, which hadn't been there before. So everything to do with genitals in the early years, they would use the word vagina, whereas in the latter years, they would perhaps be a little bit more specific about the parts of the genitals they were referring to. So I noticed those two things the most.
So in a sense, yeah, of being better informed.
Yes.
But that better information or fuller information comes in part from pornography.
That's right.
How much do you think pornography, how much has it made its march into the imaginative space, do you think, of mid-teen kids?
I think it's ubiquitous, to be honest. Some research I read that's a couple of years old, so not the very latest, would suggest that on average a teenage boy would first see porn at the age of about 13 and a girl might be 15 or 16. But it's probably getting younger each year.
And this is far more likely to be online porn than magazines.
Exactly, yes, online porn. And that in itself tells us that we really need to be getting in early and giving young people, children really, information about relationships and sex and bodies and how what you see out there online or on television or in movies is not necessarily real.
Do you think the pornography is making people do, I mean, that it is pressuring people, particularly girls, into sex that they wouldn't otherwise necessarily seek?
Yes, I think they're very stereotypical images of bodies, and that affects boys as well as girls. And they're also very stereotypical depictions of what is normal or dominant sex, and it tends to be sex that doesn't afford a woman naturally pleasure the way it would without porn.
Where would mid-teen go now? There is no Dr. Dolly.
No.
There is an abundance of Dr. Google.
Yes.
Results may differ. Where do people go now?
They do go to the internet, and young people do have a pretty good sense of what is credible information from the internet. They find it difficult to find what they're looking for sometimes. So they certainly go to Dr. Google. There are some excellent websites out there, some excellent resources for young people all about sex and relationships and consent and puberty and all sorts of things. It's just about helping them find that. So working on their what we call e-health literacy. They also still go to their parents and rarely to the doctor, but they certainly go to their friends still. Lots of talk with interactions with friends, either online or offline, about relationships and about sex. So similar to what we probably all did, except that there's so much more on the internet now than I ever had access to.
For all the innocence that seemed to exist when you started doing Dolly Doctor, do you think it's easier to be a teenager now than then?
Oh, not really. I think young people today live in a very, hyper-stimulated world, and having that sort of downtime, being offline, is very foreign to them. And I think young people adapt. For someone like me, my age, I would find that exhausting. But I think if you've grown up like that, it's different. I do think it's harder because of the sort of almost loss of privacy, which maybe doesn't bother young people as much as we think it should or would. But also just the stresses and the expectations to succeed, all the academic expectations, the expectation that everybody now has to go to university or get a tertiary qualification. That's a lot of stress on young people.
Let's talk about you a little bit. Your father was an interesting character. He was an orphan lad in Malaysia.
Yes.
Who wound up training and graduating as a doctor in Australia. Yeah. That's a fairly long arc, isn't it?
It certainly was. He was more than a typical migrant story, I think, although probably in his era there were many like him in some ways. He was orphaned. He was the youngest of four children, and his mother probably died in childbirth or shortly thereafter having him. And then his father died when he was about one and a half, probably from tuberculosis. So he has no memory at all of his parents. He and his older siblings lived alone in a house together, being cared for by an aunt and uncle who lived nearby. And when his older sister married, probably quite young, I don't know how old she was, but she would have been a teenager, his brother-in-law took him on. His brother-in-law was quite an amazing man as well, and saw my father as someone who had potential, I think. So got him sent to Australia as an international student back then to study medicine. He found it terribly difficult because he didn't really speak very good English, but he eventually got there and met my mother, who was Anglo-Australian, at a social function. And so that's how we came to be, these sort of Eurasian kids.
So you went, you were born here, but you went back to Malaysia for a few years.
Yes, I was only about one and a half when they went back. So my father always intended to repay the family debt by returning and practicing as a doctor in the town where he was born. So my whole childhood really was spent in Malaysia.
But you did come back to Australia. What was it like to come from Malaysia and the heat, the life of the town, etc., and then be chucked into suburban Sydney?
Well, you know, three things were, one was the food. The food here was no comparison to the food I grew up with eating in Malaysia.
Not just different, but dismal, I'd imagine, in your mind.
1970s, yes, that's right. The other thing was the weather. I loved tropical weather and hated cold weather. But the other thing was just the size of the place. So in the 70s, you know, Sydney was still pretty small, but to me it was this huge metropolis because I grew up in a town that had no traffic lights and no high-rise buildings. And
the year that made you is 1993, which, as you've said, is the year you began as Dolly Doctor.
Yes, yes.
We ask our guests to nominate a song. What have you come up with?
Well, I had trouble remembering back that far, but then realised that that was the year that Sting released Fields of Gold. And it's special for a couple of reasons. I loved The Police when I was in high school. And then when Sting began his solo career, I really loved a lot of his music. But that particular song was one of my mother's favourite songs. And my mother had interesting taste in music. She absolutely berated me when I decided I liked Susie Quattro, for example. But eventually, you know, she quite liked some of the more contemporary groups, and Sting was one of them. So she loved that song. So for that reason, it's special. It also has a very special place in my life at the moment with my husband. So it was a song that was sung by my daughter at our wedding a few years ago, and his daughter danced to it. So it's a very special song for us as well.
It is Sting, Fields of Gold. It's a very romantic song for someone who's dealt in the world of love and the anxieties. It's nice that that you love a little romance and still believe it exists. So here it is, Dr. Melissa Kang. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
She took her love for to gaze a while upon the fields of Bali. In his arms she fell as her hair came down among the fields of gold. Will you stay with me? Will you be my love among the fields of Bali? We'll forget the sun sky as we lie in fields of gold.
Fields of Gold. Lovely bit of romance there from Sting. It's a song chosen by our guest for the year that made me, the Dolly Doctor, Dr. Melissa Kang.